Hello and welcome to the 2020 Lowy Lecture. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and future. The Lowy Lecture is the Institute's signature event. Each year, we invite a prominent individual to reflect on the state of the world. In previous years, we've heard from leaders such as Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, Boris Johnson, then Foreign Secretary, now Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, our Chairman, Sir Frank Lowy, and three Australian Prime Ministers, including Scott Morrison, last year's Lowy Lecturer. Unfortunately, this year we can't hold the lecture at the Sydney Town Hall, but we are delighted that you can join us virtually for this important address by one of the world's most influential observers of international affairs, Fareed Zakaria. After his lecture, I'll conduct a conversation with Dr. Zakaria and put some of your questions to him. So thank you to those who submitted questions in advance. I'd also like to thank the sponsors of this year's lecture, BHP and Capital Group. 2020 has been a turbulent year for the world. In January, Australia was devastated by bushfires, a grim reminder of the challenges presented by climate change. At the same time, a new and deadly virus, COVID-19, was spreading from Wuhan to the world. Coronavirus is altering the patterns of international life. Globalisation has lost its gloss, and yet international cooperation has never been more important. The pandemic is proving to be a stress test for countries. The performance of the superpowers has been unimpressive, but smaller, more agile nations like our own have done better. Australia's relations with our most important economic partner, China, have flatlined this year. But our connection with our great ally, the United States, has also become more complicated. We have not always recognised the America we have seen on the news this year. We are accustomed to seeing the United States as the epicentre of global power, not the epicentre of global disease. However, the election of a new US president this month brings the year to a hopeful conclusion. Lowy Institute has adapted swiftly to this strange new world. We have developed new ways of delivering our analysis remotely. We have suspended our regular program of in-person events and pivoted to a virtual program, the Long Distance Lowy Institute. We've hosted distinguished guests, including Jim Mattis, Francis Fukuyama, the editors of The Atlantic and The Economist, and many others. We've launched two new podcasts, COVIDcast and The Director's Chair, on which we have spoken with possible members of the new Biden administration, including Michelle Flournoy, Jake Sullivan, Nicholas Burns and Samantha Power. We've continued to produce our groundbreaking research, including the Lowy Institute papers published by Penguin Random House, the Asia Power Index, the Pacific Aid Map, and the Lowy Institute poll. Our digital magazine, The Interpreter, continues to publish its brilliant daily analysis of global events. We recognise the best Australian media coverage of the world in our annual Lowy Institute Media Award. And as always, our scholars have appeared in the world's leading media, providing their expert analysis of key issues. All of our audiences have grown this year, in some cases by two or three times. Now more than ever, Australians understand that the world matters to us, and the rest of the world is interested in our perspectives. I'm very proud of the work done by my Lowy Institute colleagues this year. We now have a short message from the Institute's chairman, Sir Frank Lowy, who's in Tel Aviv. Sir Frank is one of Australia's most successful business leaders and philanthropists. When he established the Institute in 2003, he gave us two missions: to deepen Australia's debate on the world and to ensure Australia's voice is heard abroad. Nearly two decades later, in this strange year, the argument for the Institute is more compelling than ever. It's my pleasure to introduce the founder and chairman of the Lowy Institute, Sir Frank Lowy.
Thank you, Michael. I have delivered the Lowy Lecture at the beautiful Sydney Town Hall with some 800 people present. But of course, times have changed and we can't do exactly what we did last year. We have to do this current broadcast online. Many notable people have delivered the Lowy Lecture in the past years. Tonight, Fareed Zakaria has been asked to do that for us. I'm very pleased that he accepted our invitation, because really he is the right person to deliver this lecture because of his knowledge of worldwide happenings. The Lowy Institute has done a number of these broadcasts online, and they have been very busy throughout the year. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased that Fareed has accepted our invitation to deliver the Lowy Lecture, and I wish you a good evening. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Frank. It's now my honour to introduce the 2020 Lowy Lecturer. Fareed Zakaria is one of the world's most interesting and influential observers of international affairs. He's the host of CNN's weekly foreign affairs program, Fareed Zakaria GPS, a columnist for The Washington Post, and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He's also the author of a number of best-selling books, the latest of which, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World, has received widespread praise. This year, we wanted a Lowy lecturer who could speak about the three great issues of the moment: the United States, China, and COVID. And I can think of no one better to address these subjects than Dr. Zakaria, who's joining us today from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. I'm delighted to welcome the 2020 Lowy Lecturer, Fareed Zakaria.
Thank you, Michael. It is a great pleasure and honor to be able to deliver this lecture, the Lowy Lecture. I have long admired the work being done by this institute. I've known lots of people who've been associated with it, and so it's a huge pleasure and an honor. Thank you for asking me. It's a strange, bewildering time to have to try to make sense of the world because so much is going on at the same time. But when one is in doubt, I find that you can look to Vladimir Lenin for inspiration. I jest, of course, but Lenin is supposed to have once said, and I emphasize supposed to because as a good journalist, I have tried to fact check this one, and it's what we sometimes call in the journalistic profession, it's too good to check. But Lenin is supposed to have said once that there are decades when nothing happens, and then there are weeks when decades happen. And in a sense, I feel that that phrase is resonant when looking at this pandemic, because the principal effect of COVID-19 has been not so much to bend or reshape history so much as it is to accelerate it. It just feels like the things that were happening before, the trends that were already gathering storm, are becoming much, much more intense. The world has been put on a kind of fast forward. And that has taken place on a number of dimensions, but the one that I'm going to dwell on in this lecture is the geopolitical one. We should have seen COVID coming. Many of us talked about it a bit. We've had these very often in history. In fact, Western literature begins with a plague. The beginning of Homer's Iliad begins with a plague being rained down on the Greek soldiers, on the Greek armies, because Apollo was upset with the leader of the Greeks, the vain, quarrelsome, and avaricious King Agamemnon. Thucydides writes about the plague that swept Athens and killed its peerless leader, Pericles. It might well have altered the fortunes of that superpower contest. The bubonic plague, of course, probably has the most lasting effects of any pandemic in history. It kills half of Europe, ends serfdom, and begins, in some sense, the skepticism about divine omnipotence and beneficence that then begins the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, and the scientific revolution. But COVID-19 comes at an extraordinary moment because the world was already in a certain degree of disorder. We were going through what Oswald Spengler once called a kind of historical change of phase, moving from one era to the next. And these don't happen often, but we are clearly in the midst of one of those transformations. The world is moving from a fundamentally unipolar system dominated by the United States, as it has been since the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of communism, to a bipolar world. Navigating this new age of bipolarity will be the work and challenge of this next generation. Now, why do I call it a bipolar age? Well, Hans Morgenthau, the great international affairs scholar, when writing in the late 1940s, essentially coined the term. And his argument was quite simple. It was that you call an age a bipolar age, you call an international system a bipolar system, when the two leading powers are just in a league of their own, far ahead of everybody else. And he was looking at the late 1940s, with the collapse of Europe's empires, with the collapse of Europe's great powers, what you were left with in the world were two countries towering above all the others, the Soviet Union and the United States. Well, when you look at the world today, what is striking is how similar it feels just in the raw metrics. We're all aware, of course, the United States is the most powerful country in the world. But what is striking is that China is the second most powerful country, but the gap after that is quite wide indeed. So China is not just the second largest economy in the world, but it is almost as large as the next four economies put together. When you look at the military space, the United States is, of course, the largest defense spender in the world. China is number two, and China is larger than the next four put together. So we are beginning to see the outlines of this new system. And it actually is a comprehensive bipolarity in a way that the US-Soviet rivalry was not. China is an advanced industrial economy, in many ways the largest market in the world for cars, for computers, for solar panels, the largest industrial manufacturer by far, the largest trading nation in the world. But even at the cutting edge, of the world's 500 fastest computers, 224 are in China. And that is twice as many as are in the United States. So we have, for the first time, a true peer competitor to the United States. Navigating this relationship is going to be the most important task, not just for every country in the world, but for the world collectively, because this is one of those systemic rivalries that is going to drive almost everything that happens in the world going forward. There is a tendency in the United States to look at the relationship with China from a particular lens, which is a lens that says the US's strategy towards China has failed, and therefore we need a radically new strategy. I take a somewhat different approach to it. I think that the US strategy towards China, broadly speaking, succeeded. But let me explain what I mean by that strategy. Because when people talk about the US strategy toward China failing, they usually mean the strategy of engagement, of cooperation, of integrating China into the world. But that wasn't the only part of the US strategy. American strategy towards China was both engagement and cooperation, but equally deterrence and a certain degree of containment from the start. So think about the United States' strategy with China from the 1970s, from the Nixon era. China is welcomed into the world, welcomed into the United Nations, and the United States starts to repair relations with a country with which it had had none for decades. But it also, at the same time, maintains and often reinforces its relationship with Taiwan. It maintains and reinforces its relationship with other Asian countries, so that when the end of the Cold War comes and the United States starts cutting back on its military very sharply during the Clinton administration, it makes a decision that there's one part of the world where it will not do that drawdown. And that part is, of course, Asia. And it is clear that the reason for that is the rise of China. The so-called Nye Initiative declared that the United States would maintain both physical presence in Asia, but also stay committed to its relationships and alliances. After the Clinton administration comes the Bush administration, which strengthens and reinforces those policies, but adds to it a pretty extraordinary expansion, which is to add India to this constellation of countries that are in broad terms being used as a balance against China. India had for three decades been asking that its generation of nuclear energy be accommodated and normalized. The United States and much of the Western world had stood in staunch opposition to this. The Bush administration essentially gave India everything it wanted as part of this broader outreach. And that outreach towards India has been maintained and enhanced. The Obama administration moves very dramatically to pivot towards Asia and strengthens its ties with Australia, with Vietnam, with the Philippines, with Japan, and of course, with India as well. So when you look at that strategy, it is very difficult to describe it as one that is simply of engagement, cooperation, and collaboration with China. The best way to think of this was as a hedging strategy, and it largely worked. Mao's China was the world's greatest rogue regime, fomenting revolution everywhere in the world, from Indochina to Latin America. After the opening to China, China became a remarkably responsible great power. China has not invaded another country since 1979, when it briefly invaded Vietnam. It has begun to participate in UN peacekeeping missions to the extent that it is now essentially the number two country in that realm. It is a funder of the United Nations, all kinds of other international organizations. It, of course, has self-interested reasons for doing this. But if you contrast Mao's China, radical, revolutionary power, determined to overthrow the international order, with the great power we have today, it is striking how conservative China has become in terms of its desire to sustain the existing international system. The reason U.S. policy has to be rethought, however, U.S. policy still has to be rethought, but it has to be rethought not because it failed, but because it has succeeded and is now obsolete. Deng Xiaoping's great admonition to China, which was essentially to hide its greatness, bide its time, hide its light under a bushel, all those kinds of pieces of advice, all made perfect sense when China was 1% of global GDP, or 2% of global GDP, as it was in 1990. It is now 15, 16, 17% of global GDP. It's the second largest economy in the world, the second largest military in the world. Of course, it is going to do more than bide its time. And thus, we need a new strategy, all of us, to figure out how to interact with a China that is going to be the second most powerful country in the world, that is determined to have some kind of impact on the world. And does this new bipolarity mean a new Cold War? I think it's important to understand that bipolarity actually can be very stable. The bipolarity between the United States and the Soviet Union was one in which you were able to achieve a measure of stability that had been impossible in the previously multipolar world, which is why international relations scholars often think of multipolarity as being unstable, lots of great powers jockeying around for influence, measuring each other, sizing each other up all the time, lots of opportunities for miscalculation and war, versus a bipolar system with two behemoths glowering at each other, but fundamentally stable. I think that exaggerates the stability of the Cold War, but there is something profound there. But there is a complication here, which is that this is a much more richly and deeply interdependent bipolarity. In its peak year, the United States and the Soviet Union did $2 billion of trade that year. The United States and China do $2 billion of trade every day. And so what we face is a new kind of Cold War, a new kind of bipolarity, which is likely to be very, very different. It is going to be one in which you trade with China, you try to oppose it on human rights issues, you separate from it on certain technological issues, and you join with it on others. There's going to be hedging, there's going to be deterrence, there's going to be containment, and there's going to be active cooperation, trade, and partnership, all happening at the same time. Now, it's going to look very strange and very messy. It's going to look very different from almost any other experience we've had in the past. Because if you look at Asia, for example, every country in Asia, with the exception of Bhutan, has China as its major trading partner. China buys 4 or 5 times as much of Australia's exports as the United States does. And so every country in Asia is going to try to find a way to be closely allied with China economically. At the same time, they're all going to want to have some kind of geopolitical relationship with the United States. So they're going to want to be with China economically, but with the United States geopolitically. And here's the thing. China and the United States are both going to have the same attitude, which is to say, you cannot order a la carte off this menu. They are both going to insist on prefix. That is, if you want China's trade, you are going to have to also, in some way, be favorably inclined towards China's geopolitical influence. And the United States is going to say, if you want the Seventh Fleet protecting you, then you can't buy Huawei equipment. And that dilemma is going to play itself out in different ways, in different measures in every country. But I believe that there is a path towards stability and prosperity in this new world, because bipolarity is fundamentally more structurally stable than multipolarity, because we have nothing like the conditions that led to the rigid Cold War of the late 1940s and the early 1950s. Remember what caused that: the Soviet Union being invaded on its eastern border by the Nazis, it almost losing that war, and then seeking a kind of protective cordon of friendly countries on its eastern border. Then Stalin deciding he needed more and ventured south into Greece and Turkey. Those conditions do not apply. China does not seem to be filled with that kind of paranoia, though there is clearly a rise of Chinese nationalism. The United States, for its part, can afford to take a more enlightened view and a view that recognizes that while China poses a threat, it does not seem determined to overturn the international system. After all, China has benefited from it. It also can take some measure of comfort from the reality that China has its own internal problems. It is not destined to dominate the world in some kind of unending process of economic growth. China has huge problems of demography, of debt, and of course it faces the ultimate reality, which still exists, which is that it is very hard to mirror a highly dynamic market-based economy with a middle class produced from that process and have a Leninist repressive political system. It always seems as though these things can be managed, but at some point the tensions begin to wear through. And if you don't believe me, just look at two Chinese societies, a bit richer than mainland China, in which you can see how the politics has developed, Taiwan and Hong Kong. So I look at that picture and I say, we have to get this right, because the costs of a new Cold War, a la the United States and the Soviet Union, between the US and China, are unimaginable. These are the two most dynamic societies in the world, the most economically advanced, and imagine an arms race between these two societies on land, on sea, in air, in space, in the cyber world. Imagine it fueled by artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And imagine the many points of friction that could lead to miscalculations, war, and escalation. All of which suggests what we should all be trying to do is figure out how to work this, how to live in this world, how to work this new reality in a way that allows for a degree of stability, a degree of openness, a degree of prosperity, and a degree of human liberty and freedom. I think it's possible. It is a hard challenge, but it is going to be the work of this generation. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Fareed Zakaria, for a terrific Lowy lecture, and also for agreeing to take some of my questions and some of our audience's questions.
My pleasure.
I'm going to ask you some questions about your thesis on bipolarity in US-China relations, but I'd actually like to start on the United States, seeing as we can see you're sitting in New York, where COVID is, which is still in the grip of COVID. Even to record this interview required us to abide by, you know, strict COVID protocols. So let me ask you about your thoughts on how the United States has responded to COVID. It does seem to me that COVID is like an X-ray on societies, and it shows up various maladies. And I must say, all of us here have been shocked and saddened by some of the frailties in the United States that have been exposed by COVID. We're used to seeing your country as the global epicenter of power, not the global epicenter of disease. So can I ask you, you're an immigrant to the United States, Fareed, and immigrants are good observers. What have you learned about your country from COVID? Have you seen your country through new eyes in a way?
It's a great question, Michael. In some ways, yes. I would say that there are many things that have happened. You're absolutely right. The pandemic has been revealing in an extraordinary way. Part of it is, so the question is, why has the United States done so poorly? And, you know, I know that some people will look at it and say, well, Europe has done badly as well. But when you consider the concentration of wealth and medical talent and technology in the United States, and the United States is the land of the Center for Disease Control, the National Institute of Health, and every major, you know, research hospital and university has extraordinary world-beating technology. And then there's the pharmaceutical companies, right? How did it do so badly? Part of the answer is that the pandemic, in a strange way, expose some of the frailties of the American system. So America, is one of its great strengths is the crazy quilt patchwork of center, state, local authority, so that you have a lot of bottom-up innovation. You know, no one is in control. Everyone's connected, but no one's in control. And that's a great strength of America. Well, it turns out not when you have a pandemic. You need a coordinated national response. You need uniform standards for travel, for mask wearing, for testing, for quarantine. We in fact have 9,000 different authorities. So part of it has been that. Part of it is that the United States does have, and this Australians will understand, a strong sense of individualism, which makes it very difficult to put in place social distancing guidelines and things like that. So that's part of it. But I would say a good bit of this has been the legacy of really the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. You know, for four decades in the United States, the federal government has been demeaned, disrespected, defunded, and as a result, is dysfunctional. Reagan came to office in his inaugural address, and he said, government is not the solution, government is the problem. He said the nine most frightening words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Well, if that is your attitude, and by the way, the cuts in spending were very dramatic. They are somewhat masked because overall spending seems high, but that's because Defense Department spending went up and Medicare and pensions and healthcare went up. But generally speaking, all these agencies have been decimated. And then you had the Trump revolution, which in its own way was the kind of Reagan revolution on steroids, in the sense that Steve Bannon, Trump's chief ideologist, comes into power in those first months and he says the goal of the Trump revolution is the deconstruction of the administrative state. Well, guess what? If your goal has been to starve, destroy, defund, and deconstruct the federal government for 40 years, and you've been largely speaking in power, come the pandemic, it doesn't function that well.
All right. Part of the problem with America's response also, of course, was the leadership from the top. You have a new president, a president-elect from the 20th of January. President-elect Biden has told us America is back. Let me ask you, what kind of foreign policy do you think Joe Biden will run? During the campaign, he mainly defined himself in opposition to President Trump's worldview. So he was in favor of alliances, he was in favor of institutions and so on. But we don't yet know what will be the organizing principle of the Biden administration. When you squint your eyes and you look at Biden's 5 decades in office, you look at some of his new foreign policy and national security picks, is he likely to set out to try to restore the liberal international order? Will it be a sort of a great power competition model? Will we see a re-pivot to Asia? Before we get to China as such, what do you think will be the principal goal of President Biden's foreign policy?
So let me say a little bit first about his COVID strategy, because that's important, because in order to move on anything else, he's got to first deal with COVID. So I think he could end up getting lucky, because if you think about the COVID as two phases, the first phase, which has been the public health response, the United States has essentially botched. But the second phase, which we are beginning to see, is largely driven by the private sector, which is therapeutics and vaccines. And there, I think what you're going to see is the United States will outperform just as it underperformed in the first phase, because American companies are going to do better than people realize. The vaccines are, I think, better than people imagine. I think the delivery systems will work fine. We do this with the flu every year. And I think unless you end up with a cultural opposition to vaccinations, which could always complicate things, I think Biden will find that he's buoyed by the reality that he has managed this crisis reasonably well. So then you get to what is Biden's core foreign policy. There is no question in my mind, having watched Biden for many years and talked to him a good bit, Joe Biden is a liberal internationalist in the old school of the Democratic Party, by which I mean to say, and it's different from a conservative internationalist. He is a liberal internationalist who believes strongly in the architecture of the liberal international order that Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman set up. He believes very deeply in the alliance structure. He believes in the open international economy, believes the United States should be an architect, a sustainer, a stabilizer of that. He believes that the United States has a moral role to play in the world with regard to human rights. He believes that, I think one of his most fiery moments as a young senator was when he confronted George Shultz, then Secretary of State, over what he saw as the Reagan administration's support for apartheid South Africa. And this, if you watch that exchange, you see this, he feels this in his bones. So in that sense, he's different from a conservative internationalist who might have agreed with a lot of what I had just said, but then would be less likely to push on the human rights issues, right? More comfortable with the alliance with Saudi Arabia, less comfortable advocating for human rights. So he brings to, he ties Roosevelt and Truman with Jimmy Carter. That's Joe Biden. Now, the question you're asking, which is, of course, a very, very important and appropriate one, is what does that mean in today's world? Because I think that the Biden administration and the people he's selected, many of whom you know, Michael, are all absolutely first rate. And they are not only very smart, but they're decent, they're honorable. But they face a new world, right? So you can't just say you're in favor of this old international order, because that old international order is fraying, and it's fraying for a number of structural reasons that you can't just fix by saying the United States is going to recommit itself. The United States, it's fraying fundamentally because You have a process that I described in my last book as the rise of the rest. You have new great powers emerging, and it's not just China. It's India, it's Brazil, it's Indonesia, it's a country like Turkey. You know, one of the best ways to look at how the world has changed is to look at a country like Turkey. 3 decades ago, the United States told Turkey what to do geopolitically, and it just saluted and did it. Today, Erdogan is his own independent actor, a wild card in the Middle East. But why? Because he is politically stable, economically successful, by which I mean Turkey's GDP has gone up fivefold in the last 25 years, feels that it is culturally confident. And that's not just Turkey, right? That's India, that's Brazil, that's Indonesia. So that's one part of it. The second part of it is the United States has, you know, there is not support in the United States for a Kennedy-like affirmation that says we will bear any burden, pay any price, meet any cost, support any friend, oppose any foe to maintain this order. That is just not. Trump is an ugly, nasty, churlish manifestation of it. Obama was a genteel, polite manifestation of it, because as you recall, he was also trying to withdraw the United States from the world, lead from behind, call it what you will. It is a recognition of this reality. And the third, of course, is the rise of China. So you put all that together, and the challenge for the Biden team is how do you sustain or revive the liberal international order in the face of those three forces that are all in their own ways pulling it apart?
One other way that the international order is fraying is that the planet is heating up. And this is an issue that energizes the Democratic Party in particular. So let me ask you, how much of a priority will climate change be for President Biden? Of course, he's appointed John Kerry as his special envoy. Boris Johnson is pushing for more ambitious global targets in the lead up to the Conference of the Parties in Glasgow. How big a thing is this for Biden, and what are the prospects of global movement, do you think, on climate?
So I think climate change is one of those odd things where, on the one hand, you could look at it as eroding the international order, because obviously it causes trouble and problems and volatility. But actually, it could bring it together, because the only way to solve this is to come together. There really is no national solution to climate change. So it provides a kind of huge incentive for countries to cooperate. And if countries can cooperate around it, they can see the benefits of that cooperation, right? There's an obvious win-win for everybody in more cooperation. The problem is sort of getting you to the point where you are willing to do it. I think Biden will try very hard. I think he believes in this, and Kerry believes in it passionately. I think that they will do a lot. The biggest problem is they don't have the legislature with them. And if you don't have the legislature with you, there is a limit to what you can do. I believe the most sensible thing to do is actually what the incoming Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has proposed as part of a group, which is a price on carbon. There is simply no way to get serious about climate change without disincentivizing the activities that are leading to massive amounts of CO2 entering into the atmosphere. You can subsidize and incentivize all you want, but there are two things going on at the same time, and you have to get those CO2 emissions down. So I think that will be hard without the legislative branch, but he will do what he can. The thing to remember in all of this, of course, is China gets a vote too. And on this issue, so does India. Right now, India continues to build coal-fired power plants. I forget whether it's every week or every 2 weeks, but they're rolling them out. And unless we can get a grip on that, and that again will require international cooperation, because you'll have to set standards and you'll have to incentivize India to not do that. Until you can get that going, nothing the United States does by itself will matter.
All right, let me come to the question of China. You made a powerful argument for the United States and China really finding a mode of coexisting, I think might be one way of summarizing it, where they can each achieve their objectives, but at the same time, recognize the prerogatives of the other as a great power, if I can summarize it that way. Of course, when it comes to recognizing the prerogatives of a Leninist state, that's often very unpleasant and uncomfortable, whether it's their behavior in Xinjiang or Hong Kong or on their peripheries or many other elements of the Chinese system. So what do you say to those critics, those hawks in Washington who would say, look, Obama tried all this. He tried reaching out, making concessions to the Chinese. The Chinese pocketed them and then asked for more. And the only way to behave towards the Chinese is from a position of strength, because Beijing recognises, respects strength. It knows what it is to be weak. It remembers being weak. It didn't enjoy being weak. So you've got to be strong to China. You've got to take an ally-focused approach, make sure your allies are comfortable, and only then go to the Chinese with concessions. In other words, the emphasis should be more on balancing and hedging and deterrence rather than engagement.
I'm all for strength. I'm all for building up to a position of strength. Dean Acheson used to say, you negotiate from positions of strength, and the United States should do that. And the fact that we haven't worked with our allies is probably the central mistake of the Trump foreign policy, and there are many. But certainly, I would say the number one mistake was the abandonment of America's allies. But I think it's important to look at history honestly. So the truth of the matter is the Chinese have abused the quote-unquote the trading system much less than people think. Mostly, they have used it very cannily. If you go to the Geneva and see the World Trade Organization's headquarters, right next to it is a building that's almost the same size as the central bureaucracy. And what is that? That is the Chinese delegation to the WTO. They have a huge number of very smart people there who are gaming the system in ways that is perfectly legal. A lot of what they get are concessions made by countries and companies voluntarily because they want access to the Chinese market. Australia is very familiar with this. And then when things go sour, they come and complain. The United States bends the trade rules to its advantages all the time. I mean, one of the ways of looking at what China is doing is saying we want to have the same prerogatives that other great powers have, which is mostly we abide by the rules of the road, rules of trade. But when it's really important to us, we get to cheat. And their number one example of that would be the United States. Their number two example would be the European Union. So, you know, look at agricultural subsidies in both of those countries, for example. So, you know, none of which is to say I want us to concede anything to China. But I think we have to be realistic in asking the central question we're not asking. What is a acceptable level of influence for the world's second largest economy and second largest military to have? If we can come to some agreement with our allies as to some broad parameters, then we can say this is the red line you can't cross. But if every action that China takes is viewed as some kind of a tripwire, and by the way, a tripwire that we just holler about and don't do anything about because we don't actually have the capacity to do something, then it begins to seem like you're setting yourself up for failure rather than an intelligent strategy of both coexistence but also containment.
All right, let me ask you this question from an Australian point of view, if you like. China is Australia's most important economic partner, accounting for nearly 40% of our exports. But Australians have lost confidence and trust in China in recent years, in partly because of China's domestic and external behaviour, but partly because of what a lot of Australians see as encroachments on our sovereignty. And you might have seen in the last couple of weeks, there was a very interesting document of 14 points of disagreement that the Chinese embassy leaked to the media, which included demands, for example, that Australians remove restrictions on Chinese foreign investment, prevent the media from reporting on issues that would offend China, repeal legislation designed to prevent foreign interference in our politics. It's hard for the United States to come up with a modus vivendi with China. How much harder for a country of our size? So let me just ask you, what would be your advice to Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and other leaders in Asia that want a positive relationship with China? We understand that China's not going anywhere and we're not going anywhere, but at the same time, we don't want to live in another's shadow. We want the right to make our own way. What would be your advice?
I've often thought that and said to my friends around the world, you know, you've often complained bitterly about American imperialism, so-called American imperialism. As you watch Chinese imperialism, you're going to get very nostalgic for American imperialism. And I think that I have friends in Africa who tell me they already are somewhat nostalgic for American imperialism, watching the Chinese variation. Look, I think Australia has an extraordinary challenge, but an extraordinary opportunity. The challenge is exactly as you laid out. China is vital to your economic health, but both geopolitically and morally, it raises very difficult questions. And so to my mind, Australia is the pivot country in the sense that can Australia navigate this new bipolar world? So I think the most important thing Australia is going to have to ask itself is, how does it maintain its sovereignty? How does it maintain its independence while engaging in this grand balancing act? It is going to have to continue to trade with China, for sure. It is going to have to be somewhat careful about not trying to seem that like it's fomenting a democratic revolution in China. And on that issue, I want to remind people, you know, it's easy to get selective here. I don't see Australia trying to foment a democratic revolution in Saudi Arabia. I don't see Australia trying to talking about the situation in Kashmir, where Muslims are being treated very badly by the democratic government of India. There are lots of things going on in the world where Australia takes a somewhat circumspect view. The core issue, however, is can you maintain your viability, your economic sovereignty, while pushing back? And I think the best model here in some ways is Singapore. Lee Kuan Yew once said to me that one of the things he was proudest of was the fact that he had been able to maintain Singapore's independence in the sense that it was seen as a broadly pro-American country and part of the American sphere, but never an anti-Chinese country, and never one that the Chinese thought was an enemy. And that part of that, you know, he said it was important to us culturally, it was important to us politically, it was important to us geopolitically. I think Australia has to move in that direction. It has to figure out how can it push back, where can it draw lines, and can it find a pragmatic way to adjust to China? Right now, it looks hard, honestly, because the Chinese are pushing. And the Chinese are trying to find the space that they can enter. You know, how much can they get here? Those 14 points are, frankly, extraordinary. I mean, it's very rare to see something that crude in terms of demands being made from one country to another. I think that the Australians should publicize this. This is not well enough known in the world. I think that China, my own sense is that at some point China will realize that this crude, aggressive, warrior wolf diplomacy is backfiring. It's backfiring. It has triggered massive opposition in Australia, in India, in Vietnam, even in the Philippines, where Duterte, for his own reasons, was somewhat pro-Chinese. They have actually strengthened their ties with the United States. In Japan, of course. So at some point, the Chinese will face a realization, which is their foreign policy has created a situation in which they are now surrounded by a series of hostile neighbors in Asia, and they will adjust. Or they will face a very tough strategic environment. And I think that pressure can be maintained, that deterrence can be maintained, but there's no reason for trade not to continue. You know, I think we have to think back to the 19th century, those rivalries between Britain and Germany and France. Remember, all the while, these people were trading with one another handsomely. Our model of this kind of rivalry comes from the Cold War, in which there was a clean break between the two sides economically. But that was only because communism's crazy economics meant that it didn't want to be part of the international economy. The much more normal historical pattern is that you have geopolitical rivalries, but geoeconomic collaboration or trade simultaneously. And we have to kind of find a way to do that. One final thought about Australia, which is, I think it becomes a pivotal ally to the United States as well. I think Australia has the opportunity to be in this new world what Britain was in the Cold War era, because it is the country in Asia that is in some ways closest culturally to the United States, understands both sides, is yet slightly removed by because of its geography. You know, there are many similarities here. And Australia has to ask itself, can it play that role where it is somehow a bridge, somehow a strategic entrepot, history doesn't repeat itself. It will not be quite like Britain because it will have, you know, it will be much more engaged with China. But there's something there where Australia would be able to occupy really a unique position in the world.
All right, but with a better cricket team, of course. Fareed, let me just, we're running out of time.
I grew up in India, Michael, in the 1970s. And so for me, the Australian cricket team is still, you know, instinctively dazzling. I think of Dennis Lilly and Greg Thompson and the Chappell brothers. I mean, I realize that things have moved in different directions since then.
All right, we're running out of time. Let me put a couple of questions from our audience to you and then wrap up. First of all, just a quick one from Dominic Villay. He asks, Fareed, what is one Trump administration foreign policy that you think President Biden should continue?
I don't know I'd call it a foreign policy because most of Trump's policies were really kind of almost emotional impulses. But he is right about the WTO. The World Trade Organization is really extraordinarily badly set up. It's based on a one person, one country, one vote system. So, you know, Liberia has the same weight as the United States or Britain or China or Australia. It makes no sense. It is unable to navigate this transition that China is making from a developing economy to a developed one. It needs fundamental reform. You're not going to be able to make this system work with the current WTO. You will either find that countries sort of break it and then go and freelance, or what we need is a real reform. Trump's instinct was to break it. I would rather see it reformed, but he was absolutely right. The current World Trade Organization just does not work.
We have a question from Gaurav Sen, and Gaurav asks, what does Mr. Biden's election mean for the Quad? That is the United States, India, Japan, and Australia. And I might expand the question slightly. We're seeing a lot more cooperation between like-minded countries. Also, the Five Eyes nations are doing more. Mr. Biden himself has spoken of an alliance of democracies. So what are we likely to see in terms of cooperation between the like-mindeds?
My guess is that it will actually pretty much go back to what it was like. I wouldn't imagine. You know, I think that one can get too dewy-eyed about this, as you well know, with all these countries within the Quad, within the Five Eyes, they all also spy on each other. So, let's not start imagining some kind of confederation of nations here. But there will be, you know, we'll be back to the kind of active, friendly cooperation. The odd thing about Trump's policy, Trump's attitude on those issues was it was totally self-defeating. He didn't get much out of it. He keeps saying he got a little bit more money out of NATO members for defense. But the truth is, those were targets that had been set by Obama. Bob Gates had given a couple of very tough speeches on them. The numbers had already started moving. They went up a little bit more under Trump. But the goodwill that he sacrificed in doing that was so great, it just seemed gratuitous. So this seems like an easy one to reverse. But it's not going to go, you're not going to get some new nirvana of cooperation. There will be sticky issues. And by the way, they'll be around China. They'll be around 5G. Every country, my guess is, will do its own kind of balance of that thing I was talking about, the a la carte versus prefix. Mm-hmm. And the Americans are going to be annoyed that people don't go along with them, you know, on everything. But that is the nature of different countries have different interests. And there's a way to make this work by recognizing that, you know, Australia has its own interests, and we're hoping to find the strongest convergence and alliance between the United States and Australia as is possible.
All right, last question, Fareed, to finish where we began on COVID. To what extent will coronavirus reshuffle the deck of nation states in some ways? I've been struck that the coronavirus performance of the superpowers and the great powers has been unimpressive in different ways, the United States, China, big European countries. But as you write in your book, smaller, more agile countries like South Korea and Taiwan and Singapore and New Zealand and Australia, indeed, have done better and have accrued prestige as a result of that. Do you think it's changing the soft power of different countries, and do you think we might see more coalitions of the competent in the future?
I doubt it. I think that I'm an old-fashioned realist on something like this. Size matters, aggregate power matters. I, as you know, am a great fan of Denmark. I praise it in the book. And I think that countries like Australia also have gotten this balance right. But in the end of the day, as Stalin said about the Pope, how many divisions does he have? One would say about Denmark, how many divisions do they have? What kind of, look at the world we're in. It is the dollar is stronger than it has ever been in history. 90% of international transactions take place in the dollar. If you look at the world of the internet, there are really only two great generators of internet behemoths, and that is the United States or China. They're only the companies that come out of those two countries are the ones that dominate the landscape. So I think we are in an odd time where actually size matters more than it used to. But it's strangely disconnected from the average life of a citizen. This is the peculiarity, which is that the quality of life of somebody living in New Zealand or Australia or Denmark or Sweden might turn out to be higher than the quality of life of the people living in the most powerful countries in the world. And that is a paradox that I think, has to do with the extraordinary diffusion of knowledge, where everybody now knows how to run an economy well, how to run a government well. And as a result, you have places that are being much more, there's much more learning, there's much more adoption of best practices, and these vast countries are perhaps not as good at doing that. And that is real. I mean, as I say in the book, it's not the quantity of government, but the quality of government that matters. But I think that we are not going to escape a world in which, to quote Thucydides, the strong do what they can and the weak do what they must. We are still in a world of great powers. The relations between those great powers are going to be the central drama of international life. And one of the tragedies we face is that we have still not figured out how to achieve greater cooperation among those powers. Well, we thought we had, and as COVID in some ways shows, the minute you have a pandemic, you started to see everyone turn inward, even though the pandemic can only be solved by greater global cooperation. So I would sort of close by just saying, one thing we could learn from the people who went through World War II and the Great Depression and all that was they ended up strangely very idealistic, right? They come out of Depression, fascism, World War, and in the late 1940s and 50s, what did they try to do? They tried to set up the United Nations and the whole alphabet soup of agencies. They tried to set up Bretton Woods and the open international economy. They tried to set up institutions that monitor human rights and international law. Why? Because they saw the downside. They saw how bad it can get when nations engage in narrow, nationalistic, parochial competition. So we need to kind of lift our eyes a bit and recognize that we've got to get this right, because if we don't, the stakes are very, very high, not just around climate change, but around the whole panoply of issues, where you just imagine what it would look like to have a world of chaos, disorder, and nationalistic competition. It could get very ugly.
Well, Fareed Zakaria, we certainly believe in quality over quantity at the Lowy Institute. You've given us a very high quality 2020 Lowy lecture full of sensible, clear thinking and wisdom, colourful turns of phrase. I'm going to be thinking about prefix versus a la carte. And also, I was delighted that you ended on a note of optimism. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you for your lecture. Thank you for taking our questions. I'm sorry we had to do this virtually, but you've been good enough to agree to visit Australia when travel restrictions end. And I promise you that when we get you out to Australia, one of the stops on your tour is going to be the Sydney Cricket Ground. So please come and visit us soon.
It's my pleasure. The Jews have a wonderful saying, next year in Jerusalem, next year in Australia.
That's a deal. Next year in Australia. Thank you, Fareed Zakaria. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the 2020 Lowy Lecture. Thank you again, Fareed Zakaria, for delivering an important lecture that will be read closely around the region and the world, and for a fascinating conversation. Thank you also to my chairman, Sir Frank Lowy, for sending his well wishes, and to the Lowy family for their ongoing support of the Institute. I'd like to acknowledge all the Institute's corporate and government members and supporters, and in particular the sponsors of the 2020 Lowy Lecture, BHP and Capital Group, for their generous support. Finally, thank you all for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again soon, certainly on the screen, but hopefully before long at our headquarters here on Bligh Street, Sydney. Thank you, and stay safe and well.